It's a pleasure to be here, as always. Right, so this is a talk will mostly be based on a paper I wrote with Netta Engelhardt, who's a grad student at UCSB. We're grateful for lots of people. So you've all heard about this amazing relationship where entropy is given by the area of some surface. My point of my talk is to say that it's the area plus quantum corrections. That's my talk. Are there any questions? Oh, you wanted a few more details?
You wanted to know whether it's just the most
Ah, okay. So I'll tell you a little bit more. The more precise formula, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is proportional to the area over 4 times the Planck length squared. And there's certain situations, an increasing number of situations in which we know that there is some sort of entropic interpretation for this area formula. So historically, the first case was in black hole thermodynamics, where if you interpret the area as the area of the event horizon, this entropy enters both the quote first and second laws. First is in scare quotes because for some bizarre reason, people in black hole thermodynamics call the Clausius relation TdS equals dE. They call that the first law, even though you all learn in school that the first law is energy conservation. So the math behind this is also closely related to something else involving the area, which is the Penrose singularity theorem that I'll be discussing. That's usually not thought of as having an entropic interpretation, but I think it really does, as we'll be seeing. The second, increasingly faddish area for this to come up is in the holographic entanglement entropy. So there we have a holographic theory with where a gravitational theory is dual to a theory on the boundary, and then we have these proposals that relate the entropy of a region on the boundary to the area of some surface that is in the bulk space-time, a minimal surface or an extremal surface, depending on what your situation you're talking about. A third possible situation is the covariant entropy bound, where there's been the much debated proposal about by Raphael Busso about a bound on the entropy falling across a null surface that is supposed to be bounded by the area cross-section of that null surface. And you could try to extrapolate from these examples and suggest that there might be something entropic about a general codimension two surface just sitting randomly in space. For example, the argument of Ted Jacobson that you can derive the Einstein equation if you assume that the laws of thermodynamics hold locally for each cross-sectional area at each in a sort of local horizon at each point. And more recently, there's a paper by Bianchi and Myers that have compiled a bunch of arguments that something like this might be true. The entropy of a region might, in general, be proportional to its area in quantum gravity. One motivation for that is the area law for entanglement, which is if you cut it off at the Planck scale, you might expect to get a formula something like this. So, in each of these cases, The area is the classical piece that we get at leading order, but we can also consider quantum corrections if there's quantum fields in your gravitational theory. And so there's a general research program I've been working on to try to take these ideas and to quantize them, so to speak, by including contributions that are proportional to the entanglement entropy. So I'll need to tell you what that is if you don't know. Suppose we have a Cauchy surface sigma in space, representing space at one time, and we divide the Cauchy surface into two regions using an entangling surface E, and we will arbitrarily call one of these sides the inside and the other the outside, and we have various fields which we can, so we can restrict to considering just the state of the field in the interior or the exterior. Now we can then define the entanglement entropy as the von Neumann entropy on the system that is restricted to one side or the other. Should the total state of the system happen to be pure, then the inside entropy and the outside entropy are the same as each other. If the system is mixed, it matters which one we pick, so we have to make an arbitrary choice. Now, this formula here with the von Neumann entropy is a bit formal, because if you calculate, you find that there are ultraviolet divergences, but fortunately, the divergences are local on this entangling surface E, and so you can separate out the piece that's local and divergent from the piece that is finite and non-local. Now, a somewhat more sophisticated concept, if we have a gravitational theory, what I just said is valid in a field theory in general. If we have a gravitational theory, then we can define the generalized entropy of this entangling surface E, which is a finite quantity. So this is defined by taking the area of the surface and adding to it the entanglement entropy, S out, on one side, and then also including some counter terms in order to renormalize and subtract off the divergences that are in the S out entanglement entropy term. So, for example, the leading order divergence is the area law divergence, which would correspond to a shift in the value of 1 over Newton's constant in that term there. But there are higher order terms, subleading divergences, for example, log divergences in 4 dimensions, that you would shift by adding some integrals of curvature to your at E. And these are the sorts of corrections to the entropy you expect to get in a higher curvature theory of gravity. So then, once we've properly renormalized this so that we can take the cutoff to 0 and get a finite answer, the hypothesis is that this may be related to the gravitational state counting somehow of the degrees of freedom on one side or the other. Any questions so far? Okay. So I'm going to be discussing things using what I call a semi-classical approximation. And in this semi-classical approximation, you can start, if you start with a classical background metric, so we have an expansion with respect to h bar, you could just as well think of this as an expansion with respect to Newton's constant. It really involves h bar, Newton's constant, and the characteristic wavelength of the field if you want to construct a dimensionless quantity. But I like thinking about it as an h bar expansion. Then our classical background is the zeroth order piece of the metric. If we then do quantum field theory in curved space-time, we will then have fields whose stress energy of you have finite order unity number of quanta, the stress energy of a quantum field is proportional to h bar, and so the gravitational effects of that quantum field will be of order h bar to the 1. So that comes in here. However, if you linearize a graviton field and you quantize your gravitons on this background, it turns out they actually affect the metric at order square root of h bar. And the way to see this physically is that the amplitude of the energy of a gravity wave is proportional to the amplitude squared, but it's also given for a single graviton by the Planck quantization formula h bar omega. So if the energy of one graviton is proportional to h bar, and it's also the amplitude squared, the amplitude must be of order square root of h bar. So that means the gravitons come at this intermediate order, but because the Einstein equation is nonlinear, the quadratic parts will mean that gravitons source a gravitational field also order h bar to the 1, and even though they don't really have a stress tensor, morally speaking, you consider that as being similar to the gravitational field sourced by everything else. And then there's higher order terms if we want to think about those. Now, if we think about this as an expansion of the generalized entropy, then that will always be 1 power of h bar lower because of this over h bar here. So if we have quantum fields, their entropy will be of order h bar to the 0, and their contribution to the area of order h bar to the 1, so their contribution to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is also of order h bar to the 0, so they're the same order. So these are the area terms, and if the classical piece vanishes, the area and entropy terms here can be in competition with each other. Okay, so now I'm going to say something about this first example, the generalized second law. So that tells us that applies when we have what's called a causal horizon, which is a general concept that embraces black holes, De Sitter type horizons, Rindler horizons, basically all the situations in which it appears that the second law of black hole thermodynamics, an analog of that, should hold. So it's not a general null surface. It has to be specifically the boundary of the past of any set of points at future infinity. That is the most general definition that seems to obey this second law. And then we can say, if you take the generalized entropy of one slice of the horizon here, and if we consider variations of this slice, that's delta H, and we take this first derivative of the generalized entropy and contract it with a null direction, that's this vector here, indicating that we're choosing to vary the slice in such a way that remains on the horizon, so we're pushing it up the horizon to the future, then the generalized second law of thermodynamics states that this generalized entropy is non-decreasing with time. So this was proven, I showed it for free or supernormalizable fields semi-classically coupled to general relativity, but plausibly, since this presumably relate somehow to the second law of thermodynamics for whatever are the true quantum gravity microstates, plausibly this generalized second law should hold in any UV complete theory of quantum gravity that is good. So I'm going to be assuming this at certain points in the talk, even going beyond places where it has been shown. Okay? Now, in order to do stuff with this, there's a very useful lemma that I use over and over again, which is about two null surfaces that meet at a point x here. So this diagram is space at one time, and the blue arrows are showing how the light rays of this null surface will evolve, will move as we evolve forwards to in time. So they're going normal to the surface. So the assumptions are that the two null surfaces meet at a point, and that the null surface M is everywhere outside or on N. So the that means they coincide or they must bend outwards. Now, the statement is that if we vary this generalized entropy in just a tiny neighborhood of this point X, where we can compare the variation for the surface N and the surface M, the statement is that the generalized entropy is always increasing faster for the surface N than for the surface M. So that's this equation. Now, I'm not going to give a full proof here, but I'll say what goes into it. There's a geometrical fact about the area of the surface, which you can see with your own eyes here, that if we just think about the area term, that the M, the light rays on the M surface are contracting faster than the light rays on the N surface. So that geometrical fact is literally all you need to prove the area part of this result. Regarding the entanglement entropy of the result, you have to apply a quantum information inequality that's known as Strong subadditivity, which essentially implies that when you add an extra region that's distant from this point X, that always increases the rate at which entanglement is increasing. And it's also important that this is done under the H-bar expansion, so that I'm assuming that all of these effects occur at some finite order in H-bar, that I only need to worry about proving this inequality at the leading order at which it's non-zero, and that allows me to only worry about the area piece or the entanglement entropy piece at the same. I can treat them separately. And it also allows me to ignore the counter terms, fortunately, because it's hard to prove inequalities about those. Okay. So that's this lemma. Now, one application of this is to generalize the Penrose singularity theorem to semi-classical situations. So if you're not familiar with the Penrose singularity theorem, the basic idea of that is that you have some codimension two surface that's a trapped surface with the property that if light rays are coming out from that surface towards the non-compact directions of space, that the area is decreasing initially from this null surface everywhere. And Penrose used that together with the null energy condition to prove that, and global hyperbolicity, a fact about the causality of space-time, to prove that there has to be a singularity. Now, you can use the generalized second law in place of the null energy condition, in a way I'm about to show you, which is an advantage because when you have quantum fields, the null energy condition can be violated, whereas we expect that this generalized second law will continue to be true. And plausibly, some analog of it may even be true in full quantum gravity, although obviously I can't say anything non-speculative about that. So if we, yes. It means basically this expansion is valid. So there is a classical background, and although I'm allowing the metric to vary, it's not the large compared.
So it's classical plus
Right. Right. So, I mean, if you wanted to avoid a singularity practically, you could try to construct, you know, some sort of bouncing space-time in a situation where the Penrose singularity theorem would say there's a big bang. Well, then you could say, can you construct a bouncing space-time using the null energy condition, so using null energy condition violation from quantum fields in such a way that you're always within the semi-classical regime the whole time, so you don't have to worry about sort of full quantum gravity physics. And if you believe your theory obeys the GSL, this would say you can't. So, and more speculatively, if you believe the GSL would hold in full quantum gravity in a much more hand-waving way, you might argue you wouldn't expect it to occur there either. But let's stick to the semi-classical for now. A sketch of the proof. I'm not going to focus on those aspects which are the same as in the classical Penrose proof. Penrose showed that if you assume that space-time obeys a good causal assumption called global hyperbolicity, that the only way to avoid a singularity is that if all the light rays from this quantum trap surface terminate in a finite amount of affine time, that there must be a singularity. So the contrapositive of that is that if we want to avoid the singularity, there has to be at least one light ray from this quantum trap surface which survives forever without leaving a null surface shot out from the quantum trap surface. So let us assume for reductio that there is indeed such a null surface which survives forever without ending, and we'll call it G. Now, this null surface, sorry, this null geodesic can itself be viewed as possessing a causal horizon because it is itself something that goes off to infinity. So you can ask, what's the boundary of what can be seen by that null geodesic? And if you believe that the generalized second law holds for what can be seen by a time-like geodesic, the null case follows by continuity. A difference, though, is that the null geodesic lies on its own horizon because it is traveling at the speed of light. So let us assume that the causal horizon is this blue surface here. If the blue surface coincided with the quantum trap surface, then we'd immediately have a contradiction because one has decreasing generalized entropy, which is the definition of quantum trapped, and one has increasing generalized entropy, which is the statement of the generalized second law. But in general, it might not be that nice. It could be, like I've shown, where the causal horizon lies outside of the quantum trap surface. It cannot, however, lie inside, because by definition, it's the boundary of what can causally affect this geodesic, and a null surface shot out from this quantum trap surface is traveling at the speed of light, and therefore it's not possible for information to go faster than the speed of light and go outside that null surface. So therefore, we have the situation that I described in this monotonicity theorem, where these two surfaces touch at a point and one's everywhere outside the other. Therefore, we apply the result and we see that the generalized entropy must be increasing faster for the quantum trap surface than for the causal horizon. But that is a contradiction because it would violate the generalized second law. So we conclude the situation is impossible, so we need to give up one of our assumptions. If we keep global hyperbolicity and the assumption that the semi-classical approximation is good in a neighborhood of this point G, the assumption we'd have to give up is that there's no singularities. So the quantum trap surface has decreasing generalized entropy.
Okay.
It's a definition of the quantum trap surface. Yes. And you can easily find one by finding a surface that's trapped at leading order in a classical at order h bar to the minus one, and then showing that the quantum corrections are too small to make a difference. So this has decreasing generalized entropy, and this has increasing, but this one must be increasing faster than that one. Okay, so now I'll go on to my third example. So this is the holographic entanglement entropy. So in this example, we're interested in calculating the entanglement entropy associated with a region on a boundary CFT when we're doing ADS CFT. So this shows space at one time. The circle is the CFT at infinity, and R is a choice of region on the boundary. The Hubani-Regemani-Takayanagi prescription is that we find a surface anchored to the boundary that cuts through the bulk. This is a codimension two extremal surface. So the first order variation of the area vanishes. And we then define the entropy as the area of this surface. I guess in units where 4G H bar equals one. Since I didn't write that. So it could be the case sometimes that there are multiple extremal surfaces, and in this case you're supposed to pick the one with the least area. Now this formula is only supposed to be good at leading order, which corresponds, since this is a CFT with a large number n of species, it corresponds to order n squared on the boundary, and it corresponds to the classical general relativity in the bulk. So suppose we want to calculate the next subleading contribution, which corresponds to the h bar to the zero part of the entropy in the bulk and order n to the zero on the boundary. So in that case, Faulkner, Lukowitz, and Maldacena have an argument in which, so Lukowitz and Maldacena had a sort of classical path integral proof of classical version of this conjecture, and they also showed what is the appropriate general, with Faulkner, what is the appropriate generalization to, if you have one loop corrections in the bulk. So they said that what you need to do is add an extra term corresponding to the bulk entanglement entropy on one side of the area. And in addition, make sure that you've properly calculated the effect of your quantum gravitating quantum fields on the area of this surface. So at the end, their prescription is the area plus the entanglement entropy on one side, which is just the generalized entropy of this extremal surface. Everyone with me so far? Yeah.
So what in the boundary, your boundary surface is a codimension two, but if you could extend it in time, it would be codimension one. I mean, I'm trying to
think. So it's if you extend it in time, you since we're calculating entanglement entropy, what we really care about is the domain of dependence of this region. So that's a codimension zero on the boundary, so codimension one on the bulk. Now we find a surface that's codimension two that's in the interior that connects these points. So it's anchored to, it's anchored like that to the to the sort of space-like part of the boundary of the domain of dependence. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So now my proposal with Netta Engelhardt is that it is similar to this, but slightly different. Our proposal is that you should instead define a quantum extremal surface, which is this script dx, where you make sure to not only include the entanglement in the value of the entropy, but when you define your extremal surface, you're also extremizing the entanglement entropy. So we propose you should extremize the area plus the entanglement, and that this might give you the corrections at arbitrarily high or orders in h bar in the bulk. So once you've extremized it, you then evaluate the generalized entropy. Faulkner, Lukowitz, and Maldacena, since they had a path integral argument, they always ended up with a pure state in their argument, so the entanglement entropy is the same on both sides. In the case of a mixed state, you can show it's only possibly consistent if you use the entanglement entropy on the same side as your region R, which is what makes sense. So now let me compare the two formulas for the quantum corrections to see how they contrast with each other. So the main thing is that they actually sort of proved or derived their formula from a path integral argument for the classical case and for the leading order quantum corrections. Actually, they only claimed it works in the case where you have a static manifold, the Ryotaki-Nagy case, where you make this a minimum area surface, but actually I can't see anything about their argument that would not apply in the dynamical case. You'd need to do a path integral over complex metrics, but so you could worry something subtle happens, but I don't see that anything goes wrong. By contrast, Netta and I never proved that this is the correct formula, but instead we assume it's true and then we prove that it has nice properties that are sort of consistency checks that one might hope for your formula for holographic entanglement entropy to possess. So at leading order in the quantum corrections, you can show that although the two proposals identify different surfaces, they actually have the same entropy at the first quantum order. But at higher orders in H-bar, the two proposals don't necessarily have to agree, although to be fair, FLM never actually claimed that their results should hold at higher order. But still, it's a useful foil to compare to. So it could be described, yes. That would be a.
Which is supposed to go up to higher order.
Yes. Yeah. Although there's a little issue with gravitons, which I'll mention in a slide or two. So our proposal is easier to prove theorems about. For example, I'll show you that this quantum extremal surface always lies outside what's called the causal wedge of this domain of dependence, but that this would not be true if we used the classical definition of the extremal surface. And our proposal is consistent with this idea that you should extremize also the higher curvature corrections. So there's, for example, there's a paper by Rob Myers and some other people where they considered holographic theories where there was a Gauss-Bonnet term, and they argued that you should, extra term that comes in like the area that's important to extremize that as well. But since the entanglement entropy has various counter terms that are renormalized with the divergences of this, so that when you evolve your cutoff, you're moving and you're adjusting the size of the counterterms based on divergences that are proportional to these higher curvature corrections. It seems like you would have an inconsistency. Your proposal would not be invariant under the RG flow if you extremized one type of term but not the other. Yes.
Does it mean you compute it with a cutoff and then?
Yes. So you.
And the correction term that you use, which depends on the magnitude of the cutoff?
Yes. And of course, there's different kinds of cutoffs, and the precise details will depend on which cutoff you use, although there's certain universal terms that one expects to be the same regardless of your cutoff. So yeah, that matches on to a very long story that there have been many papers written about trying to ask whether the renormalization of parameters that appear in the gravitational action would match the renormalization of parameters that appear in the black hole entropy.
But is your point of view that there's a fundamental cutoff, and then here what you're doing is having a sort of phenomenological cutoff, and you're seeing how
the Yeah, so I think that's my view. Of course, even if one were wrong about there being a fundamental cutoff, one could still put in the phenomenological one. But I think there probably is a true UV cutoff at the Planck scale.
Yeah, you could put it in, but you would then worry whether it's entropy at any
end. Yeah, so that's why you put it in somewhere before that. And then this idea that you have renormalized from the Planck scale, in order to be consistent to renormalize from the Planck scale, at least the story has to be consistent with renormalizing in semi-classical physics. Yeah. That could distract us in all sorts of different directions. For example, I recently wrote a paper with William Donnelly, in which we resolved an apparent discrepancy between these renormalizations for the case of Maxwell fields. So we showed that actually if you include the contribution of the entanglement entropy coming from the flux of electric fields through the entangling surface, that an apparent discrepancy in the literature found by Dan Kabat can be resolved. But I don't have time to talk about that now, but I'd love to talk about anyone who's interested in it afterwards. So now I'm going to back up the statement I made that the proposals agree to the leading quantum order. But I'm going to put in a caveat that I'm going to start off ignoring these square root of h-bar terms, because they're actually confusing and there might be an issue there. So suppose we just think about the gravitational effects of regular matter, non-gravitons, then in that case, we're interested in checking the order unity part of the generalized entropy. Now we're comparing the classical extremal surface to the quantum extremal surface, and they will generally differ by a coordinate distance of order h bar. I say coordinate distance, I mean it's not proper distance because it could be separated in a null direction. So in some but in some coordinate system that is reasonable given the wavelength of your fields. Mostly, the fact that these two surfaces are very close to each other guarantees that the generalized entropy of both of them will match to this order. For example, the entanglement entropy of two surfaces that are very close, you expect to be only differ by order h bar. But there's an exception, because the Bekenstein-Hawking term has an over h bar in it, and so you might worry that these surfaces differ by order h-bar, but there's a 1 over h-bar in the area entropy so that you'll get a non-zero contribution. But fortunately, this is not a problem because One of these surfaces is an extremal surface whose first order variation of its area vanishes by definition. And so therefore, actually, it's of higher order that this term would come in. So that turns out to be okay. Now, just at this level of dimensional analysis, it would appear that if you include the gravitons, you're not okay, that there's a square root of h bar squared term that you cancels this h bar, and you could worry that the proposals disagree. Now, they did not explicitly discuss the case of gravitons in their paper. One might hope their arguments are general enough to cover it, but there's actually a lot of subtleties with defining the entanglement entropy of gravitons and so on. In the case of the generalized second law, it's possible to show that the contributions to the area turn out to vanish at order h bar to the 1/2 by using the Reichaduri equation. So it's hopefully some similar thing could be shown here. Maybe that you can adopt some sort of, you know, transverse traceless gauge or something where it becomes manifest that you don't have to worry about the square root of h bar terms for an extremal surface. But I don't know how to do that. So that's an unsolved problem at this point. Okay, second thing I want to convince you of is that the quantum extremal surface lies deeper into the bulk than the causal surface. So why do we care? Well, so classically, it's a theorem that if we take the domain of dependence of this region R, and if we take the intersection of its past and future, that defines the causal surface, which is sort of the other natural codimension 2 surface to think about. And you can prove, given the null energy condition, that the extremal surface always lies on or deeper into the bulk. And this is plausibly an important consistency condition if we're going to get the entropy from the area of the surface, because otherwise you could act with unitary operators. If it's on this side, you could imagine acting with unitary operators that propagate into the bulk and change the areas of surfaces, whereas unitary operators should not affect the entropy, since that's invariant under unitary. So now what happens if we go to the semi-classical regime? It turns out there are counterexamples that show that the classical extremal surface can now lie inside the causal surface. But the quantum extremal surface still lies outside. So here's how to prove it. So the proof involves, suppose for your reductio that actually this extremal surface lies inside this causal surface, then we can imagine shrinking down the space-time region that's the domain of dependence down to a smaller region, xi. And as we shrink it down, there must eventually come a point at which, by continuity, where either the past or the future horizon associated with this region xi, that the extremal surface, the quantum extremal surface, must eventually touch but not cross this horizon. So you continuously deform the horizons until this occurs, and then you look at this point P where it happens. Now, if we assume the generalized second law, then this, being a future horizon, must have increasing generalized entropy, whereas the quantum extremal surface, by definition, has stationary generalized entropy to first order. And the monotonicity theorem says the generalized entropy of x is increasing faster than that of h, and therefore, again, you get a contradiction. Very similar to the previous example. So this has some interesting This has some interesting conclusions for what's now being called the Shanker-Stanford construction, which is a very interesting statement about how you can possibly reconstruct or affect space-times behind causal horizons using quantum field theory operators. So in this construction, you start with a causal wedge somewhere. So I've drawn here an ADS Schwarzschild space-time. Here's the Penrose diagram. So it connects two asymptotically ADS universes. You can throw in, you can act with an operator on the CFT to throw in a pulse that bounces off this boundary here, and that will in general make the horizons come forward, so there'll be a diamond that is not causally accessible to this region on the boundary. And if we like, we can have this pulse come in at an earlier time, and having made it come in at an earlier time, we can then also send in a pulse at a later time. So this is what's called a time-fold construction, where you insert operators in a way that might not be, where the order of operators might not be the same as the time ordering of the operators. The idea is first you insert this operator, then you evolve forwards in time to insert this operator, then having done that, you reconstruct the space-time evolving back to the past. And when you do that, it turns out very interestingly that the original pulse you sent in, where before you acted with this operator, it was coming from the CFT boundary, is now coming from the singularity. So what this construction shows is that in principle, at least some of the stuff in this causal diamond, which is apparently inaccessible, can, by sort of a clever sequence of operators out of time ordering, be affected by things on the boundary here. So, but you can't get past this extremal surface here. For variety, we can also send in pulses on the other side, if you want to see how far we can get in on the left side. Or if you prefer, we can start with a geometry that we just make up that has this inaccessible causal shadow and one or more quantum extremal surfaces shown as dots there. And then we could, by sending in pulses or removing them as the case may be, we could shrink this causal diamond, but we have this constraint, we can never shrink it past the quantum extremal surfaces. So the moral here is that although the Shanker-Stanford construction can be used to measure and to influence regions behind the causal horizons, by sort of pushing the causal horizon, you could sort of imagine pushing the causal horizon further in, measuring something, and then pulling it back out again. But you can never push the causal surface past the closest quantum extremal surface, assuming the generalized second law is true. So that tells us as long as our reconstructions of this bulk, we're trying to figure out what we can reconstruct of the bulk using or influence of the bulk from ADS-CFT, as long as each step in the process involves only causal signaling in the bulk space-time, then the number of quantum extremal surfaces and their geometry and the geometry of the space-time regions behind them is all invariant under this process. That might mean that there's information that is not located in the CFTs, or it might be that you could do better and reconstruct that information, but that you'd need to do something somehow much more non-local in the field theory on the boundary to access it. It's an interesting question also whether, if I have an arbitrary space-time I start with, I can actually get the causal surface to come arbitrarily close to the extremal surface, and I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. The one other thing we did in this paper, yes?
Can you just remind us the definition of the quantum extremal surface?
Yes. It means that is a the first? Yes. Yeah. So it means that if we take the area of the surface plus the entanglement entropy on one side, and we consider the first order variation of that generalized entropy quantity as we vary the surface that vanishes. Okay, another thing we did in this paper is that we identified some barriers to extremal surfaces that showed what is the farthest that extremal surfaces can go into the bulk, assuming that you have a family that continuously goes further and deeper and deeper. So this is relevant to the question, if somebody gives you all of the entropies of the field theory on the boundary, what regions have you learned something about in the bulk space-time? So a few of these results continue to hold for quantum extremal surfaces. We weren't able to generalize all of them, but if you are in semi-classical situations, one might want to know that that there are certain barriers to how far into the space-time these quantum extremal surfaces can probe. So we imagine that you have a quantum extremal surface that's capable of being continuously deformed to the boundary. And this is not just a topological criterion, because it has to remain an extremal surface throughout this variation. Then the statement, so for example, you can show that if you have a null surface whose generalized entropy is non-increasing for every slicing, then this would act as a barrier to a quantum extremal surface. So the proof is that as you deform this quantum extremal surface, once again, there's a moment where they are touching but not crossing, and then you apply the monotonicity theorem in the exact same way we've been doing before, and one gets a contradiction. So I'd like to be able to show that quantum extremal surfaces themselves act as barriers to other quantum extremal surfaces. We weren't able to show this without a stronger assumption, though, which we haven't yet been able to prove, that the assumption is that if the generalized entropy starts to decrease on a null surface, it continues to decrease. So it sort of involves a second derivative of the generalized entropy. So we found some evidence that the second derivative always has to be negative. I thought I had a proof, but then it turned out there was a hole in the proof that Stefan Leichmeier pointed out. And so now I'm not sure whether it's true or false, and actually I still have an argument on the plane here that maybe it's false. But at least in situations where it's true, you could show that this is some sort of, this statement I said is related to the covariant entropy bound. So I've been writing a paper with them conjecturing this statement. Suppose it is just true that if on this particular null surface, if the generalized entropy starts to decrease, we can show that it continues to decrease. Then since the generalized entropy is stationary when coming out from a quantum extremal surface, the only direction it can go is to decrease, and then it has to continue to decrease. So if that were the case, since you could shoot out both to the something outward, both to the future and to the past, as you continuously deform the quantum extremal surface, again, whichever one of these null surfaces you hit first, there would be a contradiction. So to summarize, when we have quantum corrections in the bulk, the natural generalization is a surface which, of the holographic entanglement entropy, is a surface that extremizes the generalized entropy, and it agrees with the FOM entropy, the leading quantum order, even though it's not the same surface, and several classical results can then be generalized to this situation. Now, just to put in some caveats, because apparently you didn't put, you've been kind of quiet, haven't given me enough objections, I'll make my own, that although the natural home for our conjecture is perturbative quantum gravity, really, you ought to be very careful when dealing with these arguments to think about the fact that we actually have a quantum superposition of different geometries. And the fact that you have a quantum superposition of different geometries is true even when everything is close to the background space-time, because it's sourced by matter fields that themselves have quantum superpositions of different stress tensors and so on. So it's you could try to deal with that by just picking a particular gauge choice, but that's ugly and artificial, and you would really want to say something along the lines of that it's an extremal. You don't want it to just be true that it's extremized with respect to some particular coordinate where this choice of coordinate system depends on your gauge choice. So what that really tells you is you're really interested in saying that somehow this is an extremal surface, not just in a expectation value sense, but also in some sort of eigenvalue sense. There's a quantum operator acting on the state. It vanishes. But now this raises the question of what is even the correct quantum mechanics formalism to talk about these issues, because really, if we want to say that the statement is true about, we're making a statement both about the location of the surface and about the field theory degrees of freedom in the bulk. So it seems like you'd really need to have two Hilbert spaces, one that somehow involves a quantum superpositions of different possible positions of the surface. And that seems, when you introduce these extra degrees of freedom, it's not clear how to think about them. So we made a proposal in our paper, very in a sort of drive-by way, that that you should take a tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces and then think of since the location of a surface isn't really a physical field, there should be a map that allows you to get rid of the surface and just think about what bulk space-time you're talking about to reduce the correct state of the matter fields. There's also some issues with the fact that S-gen is nonlinear in the density matrix rho. So you can't really think of it as an operator per se, although we're really only interested in its first order variation, and to linear order, everything is linear. So really the questions here when I constructed these quote proofs is, could there be some sort of loophole coming from the fact that somehow these surfaces aren't, for example, simultaneously localizable in the same coordinate system, for example. So my intuition is physically, it ought to be possible to make this work, but finding a sort of convincing formalism for showing it is a bit tricky. So I think that's all I have to say.
Something outside my puzzle domain to change that area, or if I wanted it to be, to really mean, you know, pinch off some cycle and make that area, that space even go away.
Yeah, so you're talking about.
It's not affecting anything in the causal domain, and so it
should. Are you thinking about sending a signal from like the complementary causal domain?
Yeah.
So that's okay, because what you can really show is that if you have a region here, A, and its complementary region here. So in the simplest case, these are just adjoined, but you could have a situation where there's space in between the causal. Generically, what happens is that there's a space in between the causal wedge associated with A and the one associated with the complement of A, and what you can show is that the quantum extremal surface has to be inside that region.
Maybe we'll have to follow up right
So I thought you were talking about sending in.
So you just
sending in a signal.
You have the area, the domain of dependency. You have this extremal surface outside of it, right?
Yeah, maybe this picture would be better. So this is a general picture of the space time. So this is, you have a region A. This is the domain. Can you see this?
Can you see the
light?
Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas,
yeah, maybe just the
all on. Okay, can you see it now?
Okay.
So this is your domain of dependence,
mm-hmm.
and it has a causal wedge.
Yep.
That has a causal surface here.
Mm-hmm.
So you could try to send in any signal you send in from this domain of dependence will not affect the extremal surface. So now you want to send from the left-hand one, that's the domain of dependence of the complement of A, but the same thing can be shown on that side.
No, but I would send
you want to send it even earlier.
Yeah, why not?
Like that. In that case, since it's even earlier, you can affect it, but that's okay because this unitary down here is to the past of both A and A complement, and therefore, if you act with a joint unitary operator that acts on two Hilbert space factors at the same time, you need not preserve the entropy of one of those factors. So it's like a unitary operator that acts on both the Hilbert space of A and the Hilbert space of the complement of A.
Seems to me you're saying that either causality is breaking out or your description is bad.
It's not a violation of causality for something in the past that's causally to the past of both A and A bar to affect the entropy on one side.
But you're supposed to tell me this is supposed to be how I'm supposed to be calculating the entropy of some physical degrees.
Yeah, so this is a physical thing. You can actually affect the entropy in the region by acting sufficiently far to the past. You just can't affect it by acting within the domains of dependence of that region or its complement with a unitary. There's nothing that says you can't affect the entropy of a region causally by acting with a unitary that's sufficiently far in the past that can affect both sides.
I think I guess he's worried that he doesn't see how this actually would affect something on the right hand side.
I see.
I see the problem. And so this is actually a thing where the fact that I'm confined to a two-dimensional surface is awkward. So this, if it's far enough to the past that it can affect this region by going around in a sort of around the edge, you can always also affect this causal wedge directly.
And you're claiming that always occurs?
Yes.
That there's no single...
There's no
possible arrangement of things outside of there that can affect one, not the other?
That seems
extraordinary.
It follows from this is well understood in the classical case that there was some paper about, I've written, in addition to my work, there's a paper by Ubaini and Rangamani and somebody else about this, but it's related to the fact that there are no warp drives in a asymptotically ADS space-time if you obey. So let's say we're dealing with the classical case. So we have the null energy condition. The statement then you can prove. This Gauwald theorem that says that you can never go faster by cutting through the bulk but to go between two points on the boundary than you could go by going around.
Well, that's not like all of us have
Does that mean that in 2D, then, this quantum distributed surface has to coincide with the visual experience? Is
there something special about 2D? That's difficult to answer because I don't think there's any. I think it's controversial whether ADS-CFT even makes sense when the bulk is two-dimensional. So I don't know that there's any actual known examples that are agreed upon. But that would be, that's an interesting question.
Because in some sense there, 2D fit theory is more than magical.
But it might be, but I think it might just be that in that case, so it certainly, if it did make sense in two dimensions, and you had some sort of dilaton gravity, these theorems would imply you can never signal from one boundary to the other boundary because they're disconnected. So if it does work in 2D, in the 2D case, presumably that's because it never reaches either the extremal surface or the other boundary. That just sort of has to be behind a global horizon for the whole boundary.
Can I ask? I'm worried that this is something maybe discussed before I got here, with the horizon of a black hole, I imagine that that's some well-defined surface in the limit where the black hole is big and classical, and as you bring it, make it smaller and smaller, and it becomes more of a quantum mechanical thing you don't expect kind of the position of the horizon to be, addition to maybe being corrected in its position, you also just expect it to become a fuzzier constant.
So I did not discuss that before this very slide that I ended on, but it is, that is a good question. Within the semi-classical physics, at least, although a lot of people have discussed this supposed position smearing of the horizon, that is actually, in my opinion, a gauge artifact, because it is always possible to adopt a gauge in which the horizon is at a fixed coordinate location, so long as your fluctuations aren't so severe as the change of the topology, so we would even know what we mean by that. You can always adopt a gauge where the horizon does not subject to these location fluctuations. And so therefore, I think that there should be a way of thinking about it in a gauge invariant way.
In other words, it's kind of a quantum mechanics problem. I think of like a macroscopic black hole as being a potential with a huge barrier. Mm-hmm. So classically speaking, there would be no tunneling through that barrier. But then as you get more and more quantum, as you get smaller and smaller, it's like as if that barrier went down and down and down, so that you wouldn't even have to sort of WK. As you went under the barrier, you might never even go into the WKB regime or something like that. Like it would really become like no longer.
Right, so the intuition is that there's something like a totalitarian principle in quantum field theory that says sort of anything can happen with small probability unless it's actually forbidden by some principle. So when you're talking about things like this quantum singularity theorem, you can ask whether it's possible to sort of evade them with small probability. Now, in certain applications of this, you can actually argue that if my arguments are right, you cannot evade them. That actually says that there's a probability zero for certain things that violate causality to happen. So that might be disturbing if you're using intuition from this totalitarian principle, but turns out that actually does agree with path integral arguments calculated in completely different ways for some of these questions. By analogy, there's never going to be a quantum mechanics, quantum field theory has all sorts of fluctuations, but you never have a fluctuation where the commutator becomes non-zero at space-like separation. And so it may be that quantum gravity respects at some definition of causality more than more than one might think. There are some things that never happen in gravitational path integrals.
Yeah, but it changes. In the non-perturbative region, to even define the change.
Yeah, for example, one example of a...
It's like separation. Semi-classical. If you go to I over each part,
yeah, I mean, we don't know what we're talking about with full quantum gravity. But one example of a thing that never happens, for example, is restarting inflation in an asymptotically flat or ADS space-time. That is forbidden by the quantum singularity theorem, and it is also, if you do a path integral argument and calculate the amplitude, it turns out you get some sort of infinity in the denominator that makes it never happen. By a sort of instanton calculation, Euclidean calculation. Is there some factor involving the volume of Minkowski space that because Minkowski space is infinitely big, it suppresses it infinitely?
In any case, the picture here is there are quantum corrections in the bulk of what classically had been an extremal surface gets, its actual position gets deformed to a different surface. It's not so much that it gets smeared out or something, it's that it fuzzed out, it's that it's the initial effect of this perturbatively is just its location in the bulk gets changed.
Yeah, so I would say, I would distinguish sharply between two things. If you're just interested in the surface that extremizes the area, you could ask what happens to that surface as you introduce quantum corrections. I think everything I've held that you should be said that there should be some gauge choice where it's in a fixed location. I stand by that statement. That's a separate statement from my statement that you should also modify the definition of the extremal surface to this quantum extremal surface by adding the entanglement entropy term. But you'd see some of these same issues with the surface that extremizes area as well. And it might sort of be an easier surface to start out thinking about.
I'm not sure that the fact that you can make a gauge choice to put the horizon in a fixed place resolves the...
I mean, if it really were fluctuating, you wouldn't be able to expect to be able to make a single coordinate match grid.
Well, you can't. At least perturbative.
I don't know if this will happen or not. I have no position on that. If it did, I don't know. I would expect to be able to make a single coordinate match cover everything.
So the basic issue here is if you have a quantum superposition of different geometries, it's permissible to apply a different diffeomorphism to each branch of the superposition. So in that sense, you have more freedom than you might think to perform this gauge fixing.
But it could still be the case that in one of those one branch, the surface, for example, has uniform curvature, constant curvature, and in another branch, it has non-constant.
Right, so that has to do with the geometry of the surface, which I agree fluctuates, not the location of the surface. I mean, are you really,
true.
Yeah.
I think it's true that you can make a gauge choice to hold the chord with the horizon at a fixed location. It's also true, even if you allow for topology change, it's also true that if you would imagine doing a Lorentzian path integral, though it's in each history that's contributing to the path integral, there will be a well-defined horizon surface. And that'll be absolutely sharp with respect to that particular contribution to the path integral. But I think the issue that you're raising is then what? I mean, that doesn't show you that in any fixed order in expansion in H bar that there's any uniquely defined horizon.
Yeah, I think really we need a formalism.
Is that a fair
idea? To be fair, your argument is very sharp at first order. Then, if you try to make sense of it at second order in H-bar, you start to have to make more sense of that. So maybe if you're proposing a framework where you could start. It might not be at I order in H-bar, that might not be what you described, might not be more.
Right. So I think that This issue of quantum superposition of different geometries, I think this is a very interesting area of research because it shows that there's some very interesting conceptual issues of quantum gravity which are accessible to the perturbative regime.
Exactly.
Defining what we mean by a region when the space-time is fluctuating a little bit. These issues can be should be explored, and we at least know what theory we're talking about, so we should be able to also come up with the correct framework for describing it. So and it's not completely clear to me actually that this isn't even an issue at one loop. Because even at one loop.
Because of the argument you presented, it's the fluctuation of the surface. We can look at that.
Maybe.
We can imagine that because of the argument you were saying about cancellation of first order, we need to grab this other effect.
Yeah.
So there would be the one loop fluctuation is in terms of the second, the two loop fluctuation position.
So you're here tomorrow.
I'm here tomorrow. I'm leaving Saturday morning.
Okay.